Even after a decade of FISMA, its foundational concepts of hazard analysis and risk-based controls still bring up questions as to the differences between hazard and risk. I am your TAG Talks host, Lisa Lupo, and today I'm talking with TAG Director of Food Safety, Brent Kobolish, on what hazard and risk really mean in food establishments. Good afternoon, Brent.
Good afternoon, Lisa.
So let's start with the basics. How do risk and hazard differ, and why is that important in preventive control decision-making?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a lot of individuals struggle with what is risk, what is hazard, how do they relate, how don't they relate, but generally they relate. However, the hazard piece is really the easy piece. It's really identifying in food or feed any biological, chemical, or physical agent that has the potential to do harm. Where risk comes into play, though, is that hazard times exposure equals risk. I think a lot of times individuals conflate the two, that risk is hazard or hazard is risk, and that's not necessarily true. I think what many people really don't fully appreciate is that you have to understand the exposure that may be associated with a given hazard identified. You know, as a toxicologist, the father of modern toxicology, Paracelsus, coined the phrase that the dose makes the poison. And that's exactly right. The dose unmakes the poison as well. So if we look at the risk paradigm, risk equals hazard times exposure, that is ultimately what risk and what we're going towards in terms of ensuring the safety of the food and feed supply. So you can't just identify the hazard and that automatically equals risk. If we look at how FISMA is trained and how the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance looks at risk, you know, I talk about dose times exposure. They look at it from likelihood or occurrence times severity, which is another way of looking at it as well.
So I'm going to ask you to kind of elaborate on one of those points when you said also that dose unmakes the poison. Tell me about that a little bit more.
Well, for instance, water is a neurotoxin. At a certain dose, water can cause neurotoxicity. However, at a lot of other different doses, in fact, you need water to survive, it's not going to cause neurotoxicity. So anything can be a hazard at a certain dose. Botulinum toxin is probably one of the most potent toxins we know of, requires a very, very small dose to elicit a very significant adverse health response. And like I said, with water, it requires a lot of water or a larger dose to elicit its adverse health response. So, you know, when this idea of dose really is chemical specific, and generally we look at doses from a pragmatic standpoint in terms of what is the likelihood you're going to be exposed at that certain level to elicit an adverse health response. And that's where the risk comes in. So if you identify a chemical that may be associated with your ingredient and or product, it may be identified as a hazard that has the potential to cause an adverse health event at a certain dose, but that's where the risk comes in. If you're never going to achieve that dose, then you don't really have to worry about the risk. The risk is not going to be zero, but it's going to be negligible or very low. And that's why we get the term risk-based preventive controls, not hazard based preventive controls. However, if we look to other regulatory agencies around the world, a lot of agencies take a precautionary based approach to their assessments. They sometimes take a hazard based approach. And risk is not all, it's very difficult to manage risk if you're not comfortable dealing in the gray space, which is where risk assessment lies. And we always have to look at this idea of population-based risk assessment versus individualized risk assessment, because that sets public health policy. When you look at it from a population-based standpoint, not a not an individualized standpoint.
Okay, so when we do talk about managing these risks that we've identified through the hazards and then made the risk assessment, how do we go about managing that and who needs to be involved?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are three parts of the risk paradigm, I'll call them. First, it starts with assessment, then management, how we're going to manage the determination of the assessment, and then how do we communicate that risk? And it really involves a diverse set of thinkers, different experts throughout an organization. Now, these experts could include legal experts, regulatory experts, safety experts, engineers. It all depends on what you're looking at in terms of the risk. Again, you know, risk is in our everyday life, not just food and feed, but specifically to food and feed, where I found the best way to make a good risk assessment is really you start with the science. Science has to start the day, but it doesn't necessarily end the day. And so that's where the assessment comes in. What is the risk of the given chemical, if you will, presents? What risk does that present to your food, feed, product you are producing? Okay, so you start with that, and that's the assessment. The second part of that is the risk management paradigms. How are we going to manage that? Are we going to destroy product? Are we going to recall product? Are we not going to do anything? You know, so often people want to say, well, we've got to do something. Well, doing nothing is something. And sometimes that's the right approach. And we often forget that. And sometimes it's managing through maybe not a safety risk, but you have a regulatory risk, meaning that you have a compliance issue. Say you have an out of tolerance pesticide residue, which more often than not is going to be more of a compliance risk than a safety risk. And how do you manage through that? Do we recall product? If the product's in our control, can we rework it? Maybe not for pesticides, but for, you know, an out of spec protein percentage that we're supposed to meet. So it's more of a quality risk that we're dealing with. So there's different management that you have to go through. And that's where you pull together individuals, a diverse set of knowledgeable individuals about your product portfolio, how the product's made. So this may include plant personnel, it could be engineers, et cetera, to make an appropriate decision. And then you get to the risk communication. And this, it, both internal and external, very important. I found in my career that a lot of times we as industry want to communicate risk externally. Whatever we want to communicate is more externally focused when we have individuals that we work side by side with that we're consumers ourselves, that message may not be directed towards us. And if you can't win over the individuals within your own organization, how do you expect to win over the general populace, if you will, of consumers? Okay. And we think that's lost a little bit on our risk communication strategies internally. Certainly, I've not focused on that in my career, but the more and more I learn, the more and more we have to bring along individuals that may not necessarily be at the decision-making table, but are totally relevant in being champions for our brands, our products, and what we do. And if they can't trust what we do, you know, how's that going to go forward with regards to safety culture within our facility, within